You know what doesn't need to shoot its own nose off to get good reviews? Sparkplug Coffee! That's right, why rely on gimmicks when you could just sell excellent coffee, always delivered fresh? Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer a variety of blends that are sure to include your new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office or dressing room within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or use their autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that fresh coffee will appear before you even know you need it. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's never been a better time to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, movie lovers. And thank you for listening to the next 140 Project. We review all kinds of movies. But we spend our...
How long are you keeping this up for?
You got the gist. Not even the same Batman as Michael Keaton anyway. But we spent our first 3 years reviewing the AFI's great movies on their 1998 and 2007 lists. Spoilers, we love them, and you better love them too if you want to keep listening to this episode. I'm the action star who craves respect on Broadway, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who feels beloved on the earth, or she should at least, my wife Bev.
That's me.
That quote is on Raymond Carver's tombstone I was reading. The one we see at the beginning of the film. The text before the movie gets going.
Oh, yeah.
So before we start talking about Birdman, the Oscars were yesterday. What a show!
Yes,
things happened. Also stuff.
There were winners and losers.
Movie stars won awards, others didn't. And most people will probably forget about this forever after, I don't know, tomorrow, today, last night.
Hopefully they'll prove us wrong. Or, I mean, they have proven us wrong. But the Oscars are really working hard to make themselves less and less relevant every year.
And, of course, we record this episode before that show even happened, so we can't comment on what did happen. Okay, then, the coming attractions trivia for Birdman. There are six cases where a director, I'm including a pair of brothers as one entry here, won these three Oscars in a single night. Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Script. You can probably guess who the brothers are, and I'm spotting another by asking this question leading into Birdman. Who are the rest of them?
Okay, I misunderstood the question. I thought there were six people, and that included the brothers, so I only have five. I stopped when I found the fifth one. So Inuritu, obviously, mm-hmm. won the trifecta. The Coen brothers are the brothers
No Country for Old Men.
Peter Jackson won the trifecta for the King one. What's it called?
Return of the King.
Return of the King, thank you. James L. Brooks for Terms of Endearment.
His debut movie.
Yes, and Francis Ford Coppola for Godfather. And now I have to...
Godfather Part 2, sorry, yes.
And then I have to make a guess before that was, I'll take a stab and say... Spielberg? No, it can't be Spielberg, obviously.
Well, not a writer. Maybe the most classic name of all these guys, Billy Wilder.
Oh, yeah. See, it's hard to think of because who was the producer, director, and writer prior to the 70s when that kind of became more of a thing with auteurship? But there weren't a lot of directors who did all three.
That's right, at least not officially, yeah. Because directors almost always have some writing that they do in their script, whether they get credit or not. And they probably do some editing. In fact, a guy you can include in this, except he didn't fit the exact criteria I included, which was script being one of them. James Cameron won three for Titanic, producing, directing, and editing.
At first, I totally assumed that he would be one. When I was first looking at this, I was surprised to learn that he didn't win for writing. Did he just not write the script for Titanic?
He did, but it wasn't even nominated for an Oscar. So
I forgot that it was a terrible screenplay, so I don't know what I'm even talking about.
And Fran Walsh won three for Return of the King also because she produced, and she wrote with Jackson and Philippa Boyens, and she also got credit for the song that won the Oscar that night.
Wow.
One of the people, at least. She co-wrote Into the West with, I think, Enya?
Annie Lennox?
Annie Lennox, that's yes, it. Not Enya, right. Okay, Birdman, or How I Learned to Stop Expecting Virtue and Love the Ignorance. That's not actually a subtitle, but...
That's great, though.
The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance is the actual subtitle. Was shown at a slew of festivals 5 years ago. Then Fox Searchlight, who also released Best Picture winner 12 Years a Slave the year before, and I also watched that the same night we watched this. When you went to bed, I popped in 12 Years a Slave just because I felt like watching two big movies, two Oscar winners consecutively.
And that's the third time you've seen 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. at least, right?
Powerful film, remains.
And a damn good movie.
And a good choice, the best choice, actually, for Best Picture. Gravity I liked, but shouldn't have won Best Picture, and it didn't.
It did win Best Director, and I still find that scandalous.
Anyway. Yeah, should have been McQueen for that, yeah. too. His direction's great. So anyway, Fox Searchlight spun Birdman out slowly in October and November of 2014. It wasn't a blockbuster, but considering the small budget, you can't call it a failure either. Bev will explain this five-year-old movie with the skin.
Michael Keaton is Regan Thompson, an aging, somewhat washed-up actor who was once the star of a wildly successful superhero franchise, Birdman. Desperate for relevance, Regan is writing and starring in a Broadway play which is just days away from opening night and suffering a plague of problems, not the least of which is Regan's fragile psyche.
Or in a nutshell, suicidal thespian shoots himself just to get a positive critical review.
Does it work? We'll discuss.
Another one of those movies where maybe the last 5 or 10 minutes didn't actually happen. It's all in the guy's mind. His dying fever dream.
As Inarritu claimed, there are as many takes on the ending as there are seats in a theater. So I guess he just wanted it to be vague. I feel like he's dead. That's just a fantasy on his part of how he would imagine. I mean, his ego is out of control. He would have this unreasonable expectation of how people would react to his death or his being maimed. But there's a few hints that it just can't be real. Starting with Tabitha, the critic.
Who said she was going to roast him before the show even aired. That prejudgmental bitch. You're going to get a bad review from me. The title of her review is The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. And that ends up being a critical rave. Maybe liking his play is one thing, but raving about it, I don't think so.
Also, when the play ends and he shoots himself, she's the only person that not only doesn't stand up, she doesn't clap at all. She sits in silence while everybody else gives him a standing ovation. She leaves the play before they even start to settle down, implying that her pre-opinion or what have you is proved right, or that she's just as full of contempt for him at the end of that as she was.
Hollywood phony. He's proven it by pulling this bullshit. She probably thought it was bullshit, whether it was legit or not.
Clearly, Inarritu has had his beef with critics over the years because her character is
a complete asshole.
I kind of sympathize with her. I kind of like the way that she's calling him out and saying, you're just doing this for your ego and you're taking that theater away from true artists. No, it's not her job. And that's why I say, like, Inarritu doesn't trust critics' intents. She may be smart. She may be even right about some of the things she says, but she's very wrong about making a prejudgment on the play and insisting that no matter what he does, she is going to use her power as a critic to kill the play just because she disagrees with him, a Hollywood person, not an actor, a celebrity, taking a spot that should belong to somebody who she would determine is a true artist. I don't know that many critics personally, but usually when I see a critic being portrayed this poorly in anything, whether it be a book or a play or a movie, it just screams to me that the person who created this piece of work has really thin skin and can't tolerate criticism. And it's probably true because how else could you create this movie if you can't seriously relate to Regan's total failure of ego here? He has this enormous ego, but it's as fragile as gold leaf and the whole
movie.
It's probably
true of any actor.
And a lot of artists, period. Maybe the reason this did well with the Academy is a lot of artists can probably relate to that.
Guaranteed.
Yeah, that panic that he feels. It's not flattering, but it is incredibly empathetic and it feels authentic.
The other thing about the ending, two other things, I guess, that make it so that it may not be real, is one, that he jumps out the window and it's implied that he's flying, and two, his daughter Sam, Emma Stone, comes through the window and looks up as if he really is flying. Now, does she have his psychosis now, too? Or is it real? Or is it all what he wants it to be? Is it Vertigo, Taxi Driver? We talked about those podcasts a long time ago. They both have endings we think are fever dreams or imaginations. In Vertigo's case, it's a lot of the movie, in your opinion.
Yeah.
From when he's in the asylum towards the end, Taxi Driver's only a little bit of the movie. This is only a little bit of the movie as well. I don't know how I feel about it. I guess my instinct would be to go with it was never real. The first time we ever see him, he's levitating in his dressing room in the lotus position. And he also thinks he flies, and yet a key moment when he comes back from that sequence, he wakes up hungover on a stoop the day of the premiere. He imagines he's flying. Someone even says to him, is this a movie? It's a movie! He says in response, which is a nice meta touch.
You phonies!
Right. Yeah. But then he thinks he's flying through the city, and the Birdman thing is really overtaking him, his persona, which is himself, obviously, but not really. But then when he lands, supposedly from flying, and walks in the theater, a cab driver comes out, he didn't pay me!
Yeah.
Because he was obviously in that cab the whole time.
His fantasy is absolutely interwoven to everything in the film. They teach us right from the first moment when he's levitating. You can't trust what's happening.
Magical realism is what I was reading online.
It would make more sense, and I think it's actually a flaw in the film, that it doesn't take place entirely from his perspective. It's strange that there are scenes that take place that he not only is not there, but would have no knowledge of what's going on in that scene. And probably wouldn't be important to him anyway, for the most part. But I think the film is definitely saying this is magical realism, as you say, which is like a very Central South American style. Inarritu is Mexican.
Right.
Certainly his good friend Guillermo del Toro also does magical realism big time. I think it's the first time for him. I can't think of another Inarritu film, and I haven't seen all of them. I'm actually, aside from this film, not really a big Inarritu fan, but I can't think of another film where he employs anything outside of reality.
Amoros Paris was pretty real. The Revenant was pretty real. Feeling. You could argue for days about how there's bullshit in there, but they feel like they could happen.
I'm just thinking again of Guillermo del Toro. His films, you really could have an argument about whether or not the magic is real.
Mm.
I think of Pan's Labyrinth. Exactly. There's a really sound argument to be made on either side of that, whether she's imagining it or it's actual magic. But I don't think that Inarritu for 1 minute wants us to believe that Regan Thompson can fly or move objects with his mind. And there's not just the scene where the cab driver's asking for his money, the scene where he's using telekinesis to destroy his dressing room until Jake walks through the door, Zach Galifianakis, his lawyer, best friend, and producer of the show.
Who thinks Martin Scorsese's name is pronounced Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Implying he doesn't know what the hell he's doing, he's just helping out his friend. He walks in the room, and then all of a sudden, an object that he was previously controlling with his mind, we see is in his hand. This is, for us, our third time seeing the movie, so we probably have now picked up on touches, especially once you know what to look for in the film. We're going to pick up on things that are hints from Inarritu. It all comes back to the ending. Well, he's not magic. He can't fly. There is no real Birdman. That's all in his head. The critic does hate him. His daughter isn't going to just come around to him. Why? Because he shot his nose off? And his ex-wife is suddenly all warm with
him. She was sympathetic with him anyway, though.
Sure, sure. But there's just all kinds of things that give it a phoniness. Not just a phoniness, but his dream. It's his fantasy in every possible way, even to the end where he can fly. So there's people who can interpret it as real, I suppose. There's a lot of people who interpreted it as, what the fuck? I know a lot of people who were really annoyed by this ending.
It's a bit of a Coke movie, maybe, too. You do have Coke, you feel like you can fly.
The way they talk really fast certainly would imply that cocaine. We probably should have seen a little bit more of it backstage in that theater.
All right, let's do some numbers before we get too much further into this. We're a long way in already. Rotten Tomatoes people were pretty good fans of this film. 91% of critics liked the film. 304 fresh, 29 rotten. And 77% of audiences. So a bit of a swing. That actually holds up to what you're talking about. I'm guessing a few of your friends weren't fans of this if they even saw it.
I have a few friends who hate this movie.
It was 78th at the 2014 U.S. box office. American Sniper, which was a rival for Best Picture that year, was number one. We talked about American Sniper when we did Hurt Locker. Birdman, even though it wasn't really a hit in the usual sense, made the same amount of money as John Wick, which has become a franchise. And it even outdid The Expendables 3. With all those stars. The first Expendables was pretty successful. But by 3, you got Birdman, which is a indie hit. Outdoing it.
An arty film with a star who was not a star when this movie came out. He really was truly a washed up. I mean, washed up is unfair, but he certainly had gone from A-list to C-list.
Hadn't really made a major movie in a long time. And this wasn't a major movie when they made it. They couldn't possibly have any idea this would be an Oscar darling and a critical darling the way it was. When we talk about box office for Best Picture winners, this was in the middle of a middling stretch for winners at the box office. This is maybe why the ratings plummet so much. 12 Years a Slave was not a hit by our usual standards. Did fine because it wasn't a big budget movie, but not a hit. Birdman, same thing. Spotlight, the year after this, also Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Not a big hit. Moonlight did fine for the budget, but not a big hit. And even Shape of Water last year, by conventional standards of Black Panther this year, was not a big hit.
But they're a big hit by art movie standards.
I know, but that's not the point. The general public doesn't know about these films because they didn't see them and they don't care. And then you got people like your friends, and I'm sure mine too, that would resent a movie like this for how silly it can be and how fantastical it can be.
These people I'm talking about who hated Birdman, they are huge movie fans, but they don't watch the Oscars. It's all the movies that they just don't get.
That's not true this year, though. As we found out last night, the ones that were nominated, generally, especially the Best Picture nominees, three of them were blockbusters. Black Panther, Bohemian Rhapsody, and A Star is Born. Especially Black Panther. Now, the play that Regan bases this on is what we talk about when we talk about love. And it's in the quote-unquote crummy St. James Theater on Broadway, which is actually supposedly a great theater on Broadway. doesn't look like a scrummy to me, but somebody calls it that.
I think a lot of those theaters are just very old at this point. You're an actor, you're used to the best of everything, and then you go do Broadway, and it's just a really old building. It just isn't going to be as nice and as comfortable as what I think a lot of celebrities are accustomed to.
Right, and then the play is based on Raymond Carver's works, and as I said, words from the opening of the film we see on the screen are on his tombstone. And one of the big themes of the movie as well, I guess we've talked about this already, but it's a clash of Hollywood and Broadway. You get the real actors and then snobby critics' live performance, which a lot of film actors are not good at. That's one reason why so many of them are bad at the Oscars, reading copy. You'd think they'd be great at that, even if they've never seen it before. How is an actor not better at that? Well, because that's not really what they do. They know their lines. They work on movies. They have multiple takes. Although this is an example of, it had multiple takes, but the long unbroken takes, that's maybe the most famous thing about this movie. It's supposed to be an unbroken take for most of it. We do see some cuts in the opening few seconds or so. The very first shot is a comet streaking through the sky, and later on that's played off that that's Reagan as Birdman streaking through the sky, but that's the very first shot we see after we get past the opening titles and stuff and the text about Carver. But then we get that unbroken take, supposedly, where a few times it goes outside and you get that whole time-lapse thing. A lot of movies have done that. You lock the camera off. Even in the old film days, you could do this, and you dissolve from a shot from the previous night to the next morning kind of thing. Rain Man does that. Goodfellas does that. A lot of movies have done that before. But even though it's supposed to be one take, with some cuts in the very beginning and some at the very ending, it is set over several days, which I thought was an interesting touch, because I hadn't seen the movie in a while and forgot that it's not just one or even a couple of days. It's many days. And the first cut we see after the supposed beginning of that long take is when Reagan shoots himself. There are seamless edits in there, though. I didn't really see where they were. I suppose if we really analyzed it, being film people and, well, TV people mostly, but we know about this stuff by watching so many movies, we probably could identify them. Rope was supposed to be an unbroken take movie, but every time Hitchcock did this, and it was film, you had no choice because you had to do this in about 10-minute blocks. That's all the film reel would hold. He would pan into black, or he'd do something that would have black on the screen and then pan out of it again. So it looked like it didn't cut. Russian Ark is a movie that I think I've heard. I've never seen it. Never did cut. And there's no bullshit. It actually was an hour and 40 or so minutes.
Time Code is one I think of where they actually have four cameras going at the same time. They play all four at the same time, doing separate stories. And you kind of have to choose where to put your attention. But as soon as digital became realistic and hard drive space could accommodate it, directors did start legitimately shooting whole films in a single. I've never seen Russian Ark either. But I know all about it, and it was a big deal when it came out, just as an experiment, in that it was successful. Quite the gutsy move they made, because they were shooting it in the Russian Heritage Reserve, some big museum that they only got to use for one day. They had to get it in the first take.
They did multiple takes, like this movie does multiple takes.
No, Russian Ark did it all in one take.
Oh, I heard that they did multiples.
No, they had one day for rehearsal, I think, and then they shot it in one take. Birdman, these scenes do play out in a single take.
Oh, yeah, lots of times where it's, you could tell there's no cutting, and they have to know their lines, they have to hit their marks exactly.
And imagine film actors who are accustomed to being able to probably take their time and rely on the editor to tighten up or loosen up their performance, especially in comedy, to get a better laugh.
This is supposed to be a comedy also.
They have to, as film actors, behave like theater actors. You have to nail the timing, you have to nail your lines, and you have to hit your mark. But something that I really like about Birdman is so often with long single takes like this, and yes, I'm thinking of movies like Touch of Evil, there's this choreographed feel to it. You can tell the actors taking care to hit their mark and give the focus puller a chance to keep up with them, but the grace and naturalness of Birdman is an achievement in itself. I easily forget that it's all one take, and then instead of focusing on the gimmick of the film, I focus on its intention, which is to give you this dreamlike stream of consciousness feel of a film, which is very much conveyed that you're watching Reagan's stream of consciousness, or experiencing the story of this film through how his memory would see it, which would be this seamless cut out the things that aren't important, compress all the time, and just remember the things that made an impression on you. And it works. It's gimmicky, but it doesn't feel like a gimmick.
It's fitting also because of the thing you just said, that it's a play that they're putting on, and plays don't have cuts. And if you don't know your lines, or if you don't hit your mark, more for lighting, I guess, in plays, because if you're 5 feet away from where you're supposed to be on the stage, generally, who really cares? It doesn't matter that much, unless there's a technical reason for it in the play. Maybe there is. But in a movie, as we say, everything is so technical. And the funny thing is, this movie, as creative as it is, and as much as it does feel, I wouldn't say tossed off in that long, supposed one-take sequence, but it doesn't feel like it's so technical, but it obviously had to be. And Emmanuel Lubezki won his first Oscar, 3 in a row, in fact. He won for this. He won for The Revenant the next year with Iñárritu again. No, sorry, the first one was Gravity. That was the one that started the streak. And he was overdue from so many great movies from before that. He was nominated 5 other times, I think, without having won. And this isn't a bad choice, but I think if you look back at it, well, actually, Gravity, in a way, would be the one you think. That wasn't really a cinematography movie. It was a visual effects movie.
Well, in the way that cinematography can be a very technical feat, and that part of a cinematographer's job is to integrate special effects in a way that makes it look
with
believable.
With lighting, yeah.
Gravity looks like no other film before. It looks like it takes place in space.
But they had to do this movie in these long takes. And as you said, there are plenty of times where there are no even seamless edits. And how did he light it?
How did he ever light it so that all the actors could remain lit, so that you don't have the shadows of the crew?
Reflection of the camera you point out in the one scene in the dressing room where there's a big mirror.
I did read that there was quite a bit of special effects added to this film, more than we would ever see, because there's very few obvious, apart from the flying sequence and the occasional telekinesis. A lot of what the special effects was just erasing the crew in one way or another, okay. Where there would be shadows or the reflection in the mirrors, and to smooth out those edits. There's a few places where you can really spot them because a shadow falls over the screen and it goes black for a little second and the audio is smooth, so you really don't pay attention to it unless you're paying attention to it. But there's also all kinds of places where I'm sure there was a cut that I just did not see at all. It's so smooth.
And we were looking for it because we've seen the movie 3 times. We saw this in the theater, actually, the Varsity Theater. I remember this exact same room we saw a lot of big titles, the 70mm productions like The Master and Django Unchained was 70mm. No, Hateful Eight. As well, was in that same room. I think it was actually pretty early in the run of Birdman. Just like 12 Years a Slave, we saw an opening night here in Toronto. It wasn't opening almost anywhere other than Toronto, probably New York and L.A.
Yeah, we were one of the early cities to get it.
And I definitely liked it. It was one of my favorite movies of that year. I wasn't surprised it won Best Picture and all the other awards. My favorite movie that year was Whiplash, though.
2014 was an amazing year for movies. I know I didn't really want Birdman to win Best Picture, even though I really like it. I was like, what did I want to win? And I was looking up the year in films. Good Lord, what a great year for movies. My favorite that year probably was Grand Budapest Hotel.
Love that movie. Yeah.
Great movie. And also another highly creative film with lots of innovations. Boyhood, another movie that really relied on a gimmick that didn't in the end feel like a gimmick. It was a good film that happened to do something brand new and could have easily been lame, but instead worked. But also, Guardians of the Galaxy came out that mm-hmm. year. That became a franchise. You were talking about John Wick became a franchise. The Lego Movie came out
Love
that
the
year.
Lego Movie.
And it also became a franchise. And then, of course, Whiplash, It Follows, another one of our favorites. Edge of Tomorrow. Gone Girl is another one I like. I don't know if everyone loved that movie, but a good one for me. Interstellar, a flawed film, but again, a really creative, innovative film. Yeah, it was a competitive year for films in general, for innovative, creative films in general. So this winning the Oscar was almost like a, well, how do you even pick? Probably the Academy picked it because of what we were saying earlier, that they just find it a little more relatable than the rest of us, that this artistic ego was something that was probably something they enjoyed watching.
I wonder if it won the Oscars partly for the issues we've already talked about, and because it's about show business in general, even though it's not about movies, the difficulty of that single shot gimmick as well. The Academy also loves mental issues movies. A Beautiful Mind, Rain Man, Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and there's probably a lot longer list than that, where the main character, or one of the characters in the movie, have serious mental problems, and of course Birdman does too, because Reagan seems to be very disturbed.
It was also a movie about a 6-year-old white man, which probably at the time, and still unfortunately so, a reflection of most Academy voters.
And now as I picture the cast, I can't think of anybody who wasn't white. There's a fair amount of women, at least. It's not just men in it. But is there anybody who's not white, whether it be Asian or black or anything?
Yeah, you're right.
Maybe some extras, but not the main cast. One of the touches in the movie I noticed this time is that Sam, his daughter, gets Regan flowers in the very beginning, and she's pissy about it, and then when he's in the hospital at the very end.
What do you think of her as a character? Played by Emma Stone.
Right, well, her three big movies, she's been in a ton of movies. She won the Oscar for La La Land a couple years after this, and she's nominated again for The Favorite. It was 2014, 2016, and 2018 for those three movies. All 3 times she was up for an award. She was apparently shooting Amazing Spider-Man 2 in New York while they were doing this. It was like a break from that movie, and she came onto this one. She's not in it
that much. One superhero movie to a movie about, in a way, superheroes.
And then Michael Keaton was in a Spider-Man movie as the bad guy. And then he also has a fist fight with the guy who played the Incredible Hulk.
Oh my god, yeah. The really funny scene when they're trying to think of who can replace the guy who got hit by the light before they cast Ed Norton in the part.
And supposedly
Reagan.
And they're
naming all these actors and they're all busy making superhero films.
Right, yeah, right.
Even Jeremy Renner. Right. They've even put him in a cape too.
And apparently Reagan willed that to happen. He claims he did.
He missed that he did that just to get him out of the plague. They thought he was ruining the plague because his acting was so bad.
You mentioned Grand Budapest Hotel. That was also an Edward Norton movie, so that was maybe the second choice. We'll never know. For the best picture that night. That won a lot of awards, actually. I think it may have won as many or even more than Birdman in total. Just didn't win any of the big ones. And Norton's very good in both films. I think he's great in this one. It's his first acclaimed performance in quite a long time. Seems to be because he's a difficult guy. We've talked about him in other podcasts.
Yeah, perhaps Mike Shiner is not that much of a stretch.
It's Norton playing himself, because right away, Norton, as Mike, is being Norton by changing the script, which he's known to do in reality on so many projects. He's also sexist, impotent, brash. He's nude in one scene, and he's wearing undies in another one, the fight scene with Reagan. It's a really juicy role for Edward Norton. It's good to see him do something interesting again, because he's done small projects and not a lot of other things since late 90s.
It's really a shame that he doesn't do more. Now, I'm going to bring up the thing that I, frankly, am totally sick of talking about, but I don't think that we can talk about this film without addressing it, which is the fact that the character Mike very clearly attempts to rape his girlfriend. What's her name?
Naomi Watts' character is Leslie.
Leslie. And when they're on stage together, it is as clear as day. She is saying no. She is saying stop. She is trying to push him away, and he's just trying to plow through and go ahead and rape her right there on stage in front of the 800.
And he says it's because it's the play, but it's not. He just wants to be.
He just has a hard-on for the first time in 6 months, and he wants.
Let's do it right now in front of his preview audience.
Yeah, because he's turned on. The film is clear that he's an asshole. But it seems to really just gloss over the fact that he full-blown tries to rape her. She's upset. She breaks up with him. She goes and then immediately starts making out with her hot female co-star.
You can blame her.
Okay, and you reach it. But in the moment, I don't know. And then the play goes on to have him be this sympathetic and insightful character who has a relationship with Sam. We as an audience are expected to move on, as is Leslie, because we see the very next night she's back in that bed with the guy that just tried to rape her, and she hasn't complained about it or tried. Of course, she's an actress that's desperate to be on Broadway, and he's a very powerful actor, so you could infer that she's just keeping quiet because she doesn't want to ruin her career. Regardless, the film, I would say, is asking us to ignore it and move on. Now, this movie came out in 2014. I really believe that if it came out this year, that would be different. Either his crime that got her to break up with him would be different, he would do some other douchebag thing, cheating on her or something that an audience is more apt to forgive him for. Or they would have had to deal with that scene in a more woke way.
Is it possible that Iñárritu is commenting on the fact that this is something that's glossed over? He's glossing over it.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
And we should be criticizing.
You don't think that, do you?
I'm asking the question because it's always possible that we think that men, not always, but a lot of them, especially if they're artists who put this kind of stuff on screen, a lot of directors have made very sexist films, whether they meant them to be that way or not. They might be surprised we feel that way about their films. I'm just speculating. Is it possible that this is supposed to be another thing about show business where this woman has to go through this kind of deal and it doesn't even matter and it's just completely forgotten about?
If that was his intention, that he wanted to call attention to sexual violence in the workplace, then he's doing a very poor job of it. I think it's more likely that he's like, the character's an asshole. I make sure everybody knows he's an asshole. No one's supposed to like him.
I'll stack the deck.
Other than his charm. He is a very charming man. And there's nothing about the film that's implying that he's right or she's wrong or she's overreacting even. It's just the type of thing that made me uncomfortable when I saw it in 2014. And now I think is an element of the movie that may age really poorly. Maybe that's what it is. I can't talk about this movie without talking about this aspect that I think may look really bad in another 10 or 20 years. People may look back on it and say, whoa, why were audiences totally cool with this?
It's pretty bad now. Well, Chris and I have pointed out in a lot of the sports movies we've covered, because that's all we do is cover sports movies, he and I. A lot of stuff doesn't age very well because, for one thing, you've got a lot of bros in those kinds of movies. They're athletes. A lot of them are professional athletes. They're probably not very good people. Oh, my God. I'm implying the athletes aren't good. Well, they probably aren't in reality or in movies. So these guys, I guess, just fit into that same kind of bubble. And maybe Iñárritu didn't realize what he was doing. I'm just wondering if it's possible that he did. And that's the idea. Let's not dwell on this because showbiz. No, I don't mean that. I mean, in his movie, Iñárritu saying, let's not dwell on this because showbiz doesn't dwell on this. Not then.
What's accurate.
In the years since, that's what I'm saying.
It's quite possible that Iñárritu has seen things just like that happen, and he's seen an entire crew.
And that's his comment on
it. Just be like, oh well, screw
it. Why would this
be
a huge part of my movie if this is never a huge part of Hollywood? Or the Broadway scene either.
And I've spent enough time with people who perform for a living in one way or another to tell you that Mike Shiner feels like a pretty authentic person. I mean, you just have these people with gigantic egos that are given positions of power either they're at the top of their game, like Mike Shiner is, so he's using it to bully people and get his way and walk all over everyone and get all the praise, get the front page of the art section. Leslie kind of fits into this too, people who are so desperate for the limelight that they're in this panic and this constant state of discomfort with their state in the world that they aren't getting the praise they deserve. Whenever Birdman's voice is in Reagan's head, it's always reminding him that he's better than everybody. There's this real sense of superiority that he relies on to keep his ego afloat.
And there's nothing wrong with the Birdman franchise, which might as well be Batman. Although apparently Keaton said this is the furthest character from himself he's ever played. I don't know if that's true. That's what he claimed. There's nothing wrong with doing movies like that that aren't about anything all that deep, especially the early superhero movies. The more recent ones, and certainly the Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan Dark Knight movies.
They had
some depth. There was some meaning there.
They're just fun. There's nothing wrong with the popcorn.
No, but I'm not saying that's my point. Yeah. It's the Dark Knight Rises is about some pretty big elements, and so is the Dark Knight, really. It's popcorn stuff. I don't blame people for saying they're not important, but if you really look under the blanket of those things, they are about more important than just comic book stuff. But he is just a Hollywood actor who's supposedly a phony on Broadway. There's a disaster preview in this movie where Mike acts up and is legit drunk. There's another thing about him is he's actually drinking on stage, and that makes everybody upset, especially Reagan.
Breaking character in front of the preview audience, too.
Actually talking to them as Mike, not as his character. And then Reagan and Mike's funny actors don't know how to really fight scene.
That's so funny.
You'll see that shot where he's in his underwear with this put up your dukes type thing.
Neither of them really want to go through with the fight. Mm. They're actors. They don't really know how to throw and take a punch.
And speaking of undies, one of the most famous things in this movie is definitely when Reagan goes out for a smoke and then gets caught in Times Square in just his underwear and I think his socks.
Which they really shot in Times Square. It's one of the few scenes that they only did two takes of because they knew that once they did two, then the public would start to catch on and all the cameras would be out and people would just behave differently, and they really wanted people to act surprised. And the shots of him walking through Times Square in his underwear, they went on YouTube, and they did go viral. People knew it was part of a film shoot, but that legit went viral in the real world.
And also in the movie, it goes viral.
And then, it's like a meta moment.
Reagan learns the power of social media, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube.
And that's he wants to be relevant, part of his ego.
And
one of the things Sam yells at him about, she's charming to watch when she's on screen. You can't take your eyes off her. She's great. But she's not the world's most deep character. She's just a check for him to say out loud the things, frankly, a lot of the audience is dying to say to him because he's so far up his own ass that it can be pretty frustrating to not have a voice of reason shouting at him with a bit of contempt as well. She's his reality check, and she's the one that's like, if you really want to be relevant, get over your snobbery and get your ass on Twitter. Get on Facebook. Why don't you have a YouTube channel? You're being stupid by blaming the audience for not coming to you.
And he gets on YouTube without even wanting to be on YouTube.
And he gets relevant, and he likes it when he goes viral.
Yeah, because that seems to be real in this world. Some of his metaphysical stuff in the last 5 or 10 minutes, from the moment he shoots himself, effectively. Because then we finally see some cuts again, and it's like we're out of this dream world, which was maybe the real world. And the end of the movie, actually, yeah, that was a dream world in some ways. But no, the ending is what made me the dream world. But he is on YouTube before any of that happens, in the space of those days when they were doing the preview shows. One thing I want to talk about technically, we didn't talk about this earlier when we were going on about him flying. I didn't notice this before until this viewing, that when he lands and is about to walk into his theater, obviously Michael Keaton is on rigging, and then he has to walk, but he has to walk into the theater, and somebody, just an extra, goes behind him, and it looks like, and it's so subtle, I never noticed it before, that he takes something off of him. I wonder if they trained somebody, probably a crew member, to reach over to undo the rigging, and they time it perfectly, Keaton just walks into the theater. I never noticed it, and if that's what they did, that is excellent choreography by the assistant director and by Inuritu and the actors involved.
We rewound it and we looked, and I totally agree with you that it's the extra taking his rigging off. Of course, can't see the rigging. It's been removed.
But he's still hooked up to it, so somebody has to take it off of him, and that guy seems
to be... He just had a logistical problem to solve that they needed to get him from that point in the sidewalk to inside the theater. The camera's going to follow him. They have to take the rigging off because he can't be dragging all these cables around with him.
And then, of course, we see the audience come out that exact same entranceway when they do the show. The audience loves the first act when they go for a smoke during the intermission. It reminded me of a movie we covered last fall, The Producers.
Yeah. Oh, well, here's a question for you. Do you think the play is good?
We don't see that much of it. It's not like The Producers where it's supposed to be bad.
We'll get an impression of what the play is about. It's just these four people talking to each other very actorly.
Yeah, just four actors in the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, there's cheating going on because the Norton and Watts characters are friends, and it's supposed to be that Keaton's character is married to Watts's.
I actually looked up the plot of the book, and I think it's possible that when Keaton is wearing that wig, that he might be portraying a different character. There's Naomi Watts's characters in the play, husband, and then she tells all these stories about her ex-husband who was abusive and tried to kill her. and then he kills himself. I shouldn't get too deep into the woods with this, because I'm clearly not remembering it that well.
I don't know if the play's supposed to be good. Maybe that's why Tabitha's saying she'll give it a bad review. Although Raymond Carver is pretty much a legend on Broadway, and in writing short stories and whatnot.
I get the feeling that this is what we talk about when we talk about love. The title itself is kind of insufferable.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a really head-up-your-ass, self-absorbed, actorly play. The kind of thing that I would go and I'd roll my eyes, and as Sam says, I would just sit there and think about where I'm going to go for cake and coffee after after the play. No, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe the intention is that, no, it really is supposed to be good, it really is supposed to be this bare-in-your-soul performance, but the parts of the play that I see, be it in rehearsal or during previews, make me think that I would hate this play. That it would be just as indulgent as the movie is in some way. You know, Birdman is a very indulgent film, but somehow it's self-aware enough.
And fun.
Yeah, it's like a crackling movie. It's really watchable.
It's a full 2 hours, but I don't think it feels that long.
No, it's super fun to watch.
Bit of an aside here. Lately, we've seen The Birds. We covered that last fall. Bird Box on Netflix and Birdman. Which is the best?
I'm going to say Birdman because yeah. I'm not a big fan of The Birds. Bird Box, it was fine. It was kind of dumb. So, yeah, if you Birdman. Pick those three, which one do I want to watch more? God, I've already seen Birdman 3 times, so...
I didn't laugh that much at this movie the way I did the first time. It's maybe a good audience movie. I wouldn't say I didn't laugh at all, but I didn't laugh as much as I had.
Ed Norton is the funniest thing in it. That fight. Oh, my God, that fight is so funny.
So Michael Keaton, our star, obviously made his name before Batman, but that's still one of his biggest titles ever. I think it might be his most successful movie ever. And then Spotlight the year after this. So he was out of the spotlight for years, and then he got back into it big time. And he's going to be in Dumbo for Tim Burton, who he's worked with plenty of times over the years. Obviously, Batman and Batman Returns especially. It's interesting that Reagan last played Birdman in 1992. They say that in the movie. And that was when Keaton last played Batman in Batman Returns.
I wonder if that was intentional, that they retroactively made it match his own history. Obviously, the film was always supposed to be about an actor like that in those circumstances, but once they cast Keaton, how do you not make those direct associations? And even if casting Michael Keaton wasn't this intentionally meta thing, he still knocked this out of the park. It's an exceptional, unimpeachable performance that also happens to have this eerie parallel to his own career. And it seems to have revived his career. And we barely saw him for like 15, 20 years. He was in these B-movies, you know, horror movies. It's strange that he disappeared because I never understood why, after refusing to do the third Batman film, his career kind of went away. Maybe he got blacklisted because he didn't work with the franchise and keep up even though Tim Burton left.
People can blacklist it for dumb reasons sometimes,
too. It's true.
You didn't play ball exactly the way you wanted to. Never mind Me Too stuff, which is one of the reasons a lot of actresses have lost their careers. But even actors or women that weren't in the Me Too thing maybe said the wrong thing to Spielberg or even somebody lesser than that suddenly. Don't hire that person ever again.
Yeah, just didn't play ball with the right
It's a very petty town.
One way or another. Yeah, it's possible. He came in this movie and just reminded us what we've all been missing for decades.
And he should have...
He's an incredibly charismatic actor.
He should have won the Oscar this year. I still resent like hell. Not only that he didn't win, because he really should have. His only nomination ever so far.
But your nemesis
Eddie
won.
Redmayne doing a fingernail deep analysis of Stephen Hawking. I don't like that actor to begin with. That movie is bad. The Theory of Everything.
I believe in that year that movie and The Imitation Game, two terrible movies that got Best Picture nominations. What a crime. They were garbage. I liked his performance better just for the sense of physicality. I think he really nailed it. But in retrospect, now in 2014...
It should have been Keaton.
It should have been Keaton. Eddie Redmayne will have many more opportunities to wow us. He's a young actor. Keaton and this performance, best of his career, which was a pretty damn good career, even if it hasn't been doing much for the last few decades.
I love them in The Paper. It's one of my favorite movies from the 90s. Mm. Not one of my top 10 movies, and you say one of your favorites. I'm talking about hundreds of movies I loved. Big fan of that movie. We talked about Norton and Stone already. So Naomi Watts, who plays Leslie, we covered her in Mulholland Drive a couple years ago, which is still the best thing she's ever done. She's so great in that movie. She was in 21 Grams for Inuyasha 2 quite a few years before. And then The Impossible. Those are her two Oscar nominations, 21 Grams and The Impossible. And, of course, didn't win either time. And as I've said before in other podcasts, she's one of my favorite modern actresses. And now that she's about 50, we're not going to see her in too many other major roles. Not that this is a major role, supporting actress in this movie, and didn't even get nominated for it. It was Emma Stone who did.
I feel like this is changing, the stigma that actresses turn a certain age and then their Best Buy date. But if you look at the actresses who are popular in Hollywood now, who's like a young hot star? You might say
Emma Stone.
Emma Stone. Okay, which movie do you think is more likely to get greenlit? A movie starring Emma Stone or a movie starring Cate Blanchett or a movie starring Meryl Streep?
Emma Stone.
I think really?
Yes.
Meryl Streep or Emma Stone?
I started answering when you said Blanchett. I love Blanchett. That's the best actor of those three people you just mentioned, I think. But excluding Meryl Streep, the Dame of Hollywood, the Grand Dame, it would be Emma Stone over someone like Cate Blanchett. That's part of the problem in Hollywood.
I don't know about that.
Well, I hope you're right. Let's say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but at the very least, it has changed dramatically for older actresses in Hollywood. I think it's a completely different world. Naomi Watts may not be the biggest A-lister there is out there, but she's an exceptional talent and a household name. And I think she can still sell tickets, and I think that she can still get movies greenlit.
And as we said in the preview podcast last week, 2018 was a damn good year for women leads and movies about women as much as men, if not entirely about them. Zach Galifianakis is Regan's agent, Jake. We know from the Hangover trilogy, he's a stand-up comic, deadpan. Pretty good in the movie. I thought he was fine. And Andrea Riseborough, whatever her name is, Laura, that's Regan's fuck friend. She may be pregnant, and then he doesn't seem to care. There's a little subplot there that gets glossed over as well.
She's great. I'd love to see her in more
and
stuff.
And she is really sexy. I never really thought of her that way before. She's been in a lot of movies, Oblivion with Tom Cruise. And I haven't seen this yet. I have to see this at some point because people rave about how weird and cool it is. But she's Mandy in Mandy, the Nicolas Cage movie.
Is she really?
Yeah.
We've got to see that one.
And then Amy Ryan is Sylvia. She's the ex of Regan. She's 17 years younger than Michael Keaton. So there's another Hollywood cliche, I guess. And she got nominated for Gone Baby Gone not that many years before this. Maybe about 7 years before this.
She's there to kind of make him seem human. Or make him seem more empathetic, I think. She's the person who loves him, even with all of his flaws.
Even more than his daughter seems to.
Yeah, and even though he drives her crazy and he brings up all the reasons that she shouldn't love him, she still loves him, and it gives the audience permission to love him even though he is bearing some pretty massive flaws in his character.
The writer, director, producer Alejandro González Sorda, he goes by G now, Iñárritu. We mentioned, I think, pretty much his entire resume. His last movie was The Revenant, where he won the Best Director Oscar for the second year in a row after this one. And there's still nothing upcoming on his slate.
Him and Leonardo DiCaprio. Leonardo DiCaprio also has not done anything really since The Revenant.
When he won an
Oscar,
too.
That movie ruined them. Both of them.
And The Revenant was supposed to come before Birdman, but Leo was delayed on Wolf of Wall Street. And then they did Birdman. It was almost like the Zemeckis thing, where he squeezed What Lies Beneath in between when they did Castaway, and they took a break. Spielberg has done multiple movies in a year. Like Schindler's List was almost, I don't know, but rushed is maybe a strong way of putting it, but Jurassic Park's in post-production and he's filming Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing with this, where he's jamming a small movie. And it didn't take that long to shoot Birdman because they did so much prep. This is the kind of movie you have to prep so much for because you can't really cut out an entire sequence.
Well, one of the things he said is you have to do the editing in pre-production. So often filmmakers really do rely on editing to set the pace, to in many ways tell the story, but he had to be sure that script was exactly how he wanted it and how he wanted the film to look in the end, because there would be no leeway. You either cut out an entire scene or you leave it in exactly as is. You can't change it after the fact.
And for a two-hour movie, I don't think it's got any fat on it. You need the things that are in there, mostly.
There's a little fat. I have a problem with the scenes that take place outside of his perspective.
Okay.
Since it's supposed to be this very subjective film. But regardless, he pays respect to editing by talking about how much work he had to do because he couldn't edit it.
Well, the movie does have editors. Douglas Kreiss, or Kreiss, C-R-I-S-E, and Stephen Mirion, who did Traffic and Mary the
Not film. Only did it need an editor, it needed two editors.
It only took 2 weeks, though, apparently, to do it. Well, only a couple weeks. There's 16 visible edits, and there's a lot more that we didn't actually see. And by the way, the long takes, they're one thing, but the camera is always moving, at least slightly.
People have been talking a lot this year about which professions should and shouldn't get an Oscar category. Who knows? They did or did not do certain awards during the commercial. I know
they said they're not going to. They changed that again.
We'll see. Cinematography, obviously, is an Oscar category, but this film can make an argument for camera operator because this is a talented man that could strap that camera to his body, move with that kind of fluidity, but not even just that. The finesse and the athleticism it would take for the whip pans and to just always get it right and always get people in frame. It is an incredible feat. You have to give so much credit to this camera operator. Wish I knew his name. I'm going to give so much credit to this guy. I don't even know his
Cinematographers usually mention, I think they do, at least camera operators when they win awards. And I don't know if Lubezki did. He should have.
I did read, though, that when they were building the set, they built it to accommodate him. Because apparently he has big feet, so they've made all the stairs extra deep so that his feet wouldn't trip. Yeah, yeah.
The writers were Iñárritu himself, Nicholas Jacobone, Alexander Dinelaris, and Armando Bo, who all won Oscars that night. And the producers, there were 12 of them, including those four writers, and also Arnon Milchan, who's been on stage a lot recently. He was also on stage, I think, for 12 Years a Slave. He wasn't one of the three producers, or four, whatever it was, for that movie that won. He didn't get an award this night either, but he has been involved in a lot of movies as an executive producer, or a producer who just doesn't get the actual Oscar. The film is 185-1. We watched the Blu-ray. This is the first Best Picture winner shot entirely digitally. A lot of movies had been somewhat digital. That's what they say online.
Wow. I'm surprised it took that long.
The composer, Antonio Sanchez, his only movie as a composer, drum-heavy score, same year as Whiplash, which is obviously about drums. And it didn't win the Oscar for all kinds of technical reasons about the fact that they use classical music, but it should have at least been nominated for an Oscar, and it wasn't.
Yeah, I love this score. It's only a drum kit. There's no other instruments, aside from obviously the classical parts. Iñárritu decided to do that because he thought it would work without editing to maintain the rhythm that was so important, especially for comedy, to just keep it cracking. And goddamn, does it work. What an incredible score.
Maybe it's supposed to drive you a little nuts, too, because drums playing repetitively can be irritating.
And it's like surprising. It's dynamic. It's unsettling. It's exciting, but it's never predictable or comfortable. So yeah, it kind of keeps you on edge.
All right, some connections. We talked about the Batman-Birdman thing. And the characters worrying so much about what a critic thinks is a big part of Ratatouille and Waiting for Guffman. There's also similarities to A Star is Born, Living in Oblivion, and then The Virtue of Ignorance subtitle of this movie, which is the name of Tabitha's review, reminded me of Citizen Kane, because when he went into Hollywood, he was ignorant about Hollywood. It was the reverse of this. Reagan isn't cut out for it, according to her and many other people. Welles was cut out for filmmaking, but I'm sure a ton of people said, what's this kid doing here? What does he know?
He said he never could have made Citizen Kane were it not for his ignorance, because he just had these big ideas and didn't realize how hard it was going to be. And if he had known how hard it was going to be, he never would have made that film. I have another connection I want to make that I thought was a neat little touch. Every time you're outside in the New York set, you see all this Phantom of the Opera stuff, because I guess that's the play that's playing across the street. And felt like it had to be intentional because you see it so much. Part of it could be licensing, but I think more significantly, you're looking at one of the most successful plays in Broadway history. That play has run since the mid-80s.
By Phantom, by Phantom.
That was the ad in Toronto that we heard for years and years. Good luck finding a person that's never seen Phantom.
Not on Broadway or on theater.
You've never seen it in the theater?
I've seen the movie.
Oh my goodness. It also happens to be about an actor or performer who's disfigured and haunts the theater for all of his days. He's wearing a mask, just like Birdman wears a mask, just like he has the bandage on his face at the end of the movie. And he's obsessing over the beautiful young actress who's coming up. There are parallels right there. I think more than anything, though, is the notion of that's a very successful play, even though probably critics would say it's far from the best thing that Broadway's ever seen.
I would never do Phantom. I'm my own kind of Phantom, unless that's a bad guy, and then I wouldn't play that. All right, so Birdman won the four Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director, the screenplay, and the cinematography. It was nominated for Best Actor, Keaton, of course, Supporting Actor, Edward Norton, Supporting Actress, Emma Stone, the sound and the sound effects. So the day after the 2019, for the 2018 movies, Oscars, this is a movie that's now 5 years old. I think it's aged pretty well. I still like it. Still one of my favorites of that year. What about you? Your last thoughts on Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance?
It's far from perfect. It's really indulgent. It's frustrating, confusing at times, but it's so innovative and successful at what it does work that it doesn't matter to me, especially after multiple viewings, which I recommend because the film's above all else highly watchable. I would liken it to watching an acrobat learning a new trick and then sticking the landing for the very first time. Like, it may be clumsy and it may be messy, but it's also so jaw-dropping and exciting to watch. And even 4-ish, 5 years after the first time we saw it, it still gives me chills.
All right, so it's the best of the Best Picture winners this month, then. Driving Miss Daisy and Hurt Locker, but the other two.
Oh, by a country mile, yeah. But that's kind of a personal opinion thing. There's a lot of flaws that we could parse. Yeah. We were easy on it at times and didn't focus on the things that don't work about it. But I'm telling you, each time I watch it, I am less and less concerned with the things that don't work and more thrilled by the things that do.
And if Roma and Cuarón won Oscars last night, then you've got another one for these three amigos. Del Toro, Iñárritu, and Cuarón. And it started with Cuarón on Gravity, and then it was 2 years in a row for Iñárritu. I was surprised by that, and the direction I would have picked of the two of them, which was the best direction, was probably The Revenant, at least technically, but I like this movie more. I've never seen The Revenant a second time, but I've watched Birdman, as we said, three times.
I don't know if I could watch The Revenant another time. It was like torture porn. I hope when Inuyuritu does get back to work and make another film, that he goes back to comedy. He's good at it.
I think his best movie, though, might be, and I haven't seen it in a long time, but Amoros Perros.
Okay, I haven't seen that one.
You don't want to see it because the dog fighting.
I don't want to see that. Well, I'll never see that movie.
Very vivid. It was not real dogs. When they fought each other, they weren't real dogs. Okay, so Birdman, good film. When we return in 7 days, it'll be March, and we're going to delight the fanboys by talking about the title that put Chris Nolan on the map, Memento. Haven't watched this in quite a few years either, but it's one of those movies I could probably talk about now without even doing any work on it or seeing it again. The coming attractions trivia for Memento. It's not just those fanboys out there. Critics have liked Nolan a lot, too. So how many Nolan-directed films failed to get a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Memento. But if you can't wait until then, there's lots more stuff from us, and it's on our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. We've covered hundreds of movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. We're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT.
Bye-bye, and fuck you.
And gut.
That's in the movie. He says that to
Birdman. At the very end.
Yeah, just so people know, I'm not being an asshole.